Good morning and welcome to Talking About California. I'm Cal Winslow, your host this morning. I'm director of the Mendocino Institute, a not-for-profit research and education center on the coast. Our guest this morning is Joshua Peschtoldt, a teacher and a teacher's union leader. Josh, it's okay if I call you Josh?
Yes, absolutely.
Great. Josh is president of the California Federation of Teachers, the CFT, and he's a vice president of the California Federation of Labor, the state's leading labor body. Josh was born and raised in Los Angeles, California, and he graduated from Fairfax High School in L.A. He earned a B.A. in philosophy from UC Santa Cruz and later an M.A. in Latin American Studies from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Josh taught ESL for 2 years in Cali, Colombia, and social studies for 21 years at the Manual Arts High School in Los Angeles. He also coached tennis there and taught a murals painting class. Josh has been active in his local United Teachers of Los Angeles in every capacity for more than 25 years. He began a life of union activism as an elected union rep at his school. In 2005, he was elected president of UTLA, United Teachers of Los Angeles, where he was active in creating a reform caucus in that local, the second largest teachers union in the United States. Josh was a leader in organizing the historic 48-day march from Bakersfield to Sacramento through the Central Valley to highlight the state's economic and budget crisis. He was elected president of the CFT, the California Federation of Teachers, in March of 2010. So, Josh, again, good morning.
Good morning, Cal, and just to make sure we get the record straight on this. In 2005, I was elected president of the AFT part of United Teachers Los Angeles. United Teachers Los Angeles was the first merged local in the country of AFT and NEA. And so we have, there's a president of the whole union, and then there are presidents of the NEA and the AFT parts of that union. So just to set the record straight.
No, that's right, and I'm sorry about that, but it takes us right to my first question, because what I thought we would begin with some, just a bit of background. Can you tell us about your union, the CFT? Maybe you could describe it a bit, and also tell us what you think about its role and its responsibilities.
Well, the CFT is a the state affiliate of the American Federation of Teachers. We were organized in 1919, so we have a long, rich history. We have approximately 75,000 members across the state. We represent more than that, over 100,000. We represent members both in pre-K, early childhood educators, K through 12. We represent workers in the community colleges, as well as teachers in the UC system. And we represent both certificated, those with teaching credentials, as well as classified. So we really represent the broad spectrum of educators in California. We have a history as a very progressive union in the labor movement, of which I'm very proud. And we have historically fought to bring funding to public education, particularly that's been particularly true over the last 30 years in the wake of Prop 13. But we've also committed ourselves to fighting for the communities in which we work and teach. So we're not narrowly focused on education. We understand that education, our schools, take place within a political context, and that is communities that very often face enormous challenges. So we fight both for education as well as services for our communities, and we like to think of ourselves as a social justice union, which means we're not narrowly focused on salary and benefit issues, although those are incredibly important to us. We think that to move the labor movement and to move a progressive agenda in this country, you've got to build links with community organizations and fight more broadly than what might be sort of narrow self-interest.
And again, you know, to clarify what might be some confusion, you're not the only teachers' union in the state, and I think maybe up here some of our teachers belong to another organization. Is that
right? Well, yes, we're the smaller of the two statewide teacher unions. The other, there are actually several teachers' unions, but the big one is the California Teachers Association, of which I'm also a member. And have been a member of both unions going back to the mid-80s. As I said earlier, I come from a local that is a merged local. And the California Teachers Association represents over, I think, 300,000 educators, mostly K-12, some community college, and primarily certificated, those people who teach in the classrooms. There's another teachers' union, and that's the California Faculty Association. They represent teachers in the Cal State system. So, I think it's fair to say that the CFT represents the broadest spectrum of education workers in the state.
Okay, now this is a program about California, and careful listeners over the past month, I think, will remember that nearly every one of our guests has begun his or her discussion of their life and work in California with a recognition of California's public schools, its public education system. I think that's no exaggeration whatsoever. Last month, Robin Kelly, a distinguished professor of history at UCLA, talked about his undergraduate education at Long Beach State. This last week, Rebecca Solnit, the wonderful writer, talked about her experience as a community college student and then at San Francisco State. And her, before that, Julie Guthman talked about developing the community studies programs at the University of program at the University of Santa Cruz. So literally, then everyone has looked back to the foundational experience in public education. So let's get right to it, Josh. What went wrong? You know, now what we seem to say is from first to worst. How did this happen? What's been your experience?
Well, first, I think it's important to note, Cal, that in fighting for more funding for public education in California, and in highlighting sort of the decline of funding and where we stack up relative to the other states, that we don't want to romanticize where California public schools were when I was in high school or in elementary school. California, I think it's fair to say California has never properly funded its schools, even in the so-called glory days of education in California. I've looked back at the records of teachers organizing in the 1950s, and they were fighting for more funding, for smaller class size. They were doing it in the 50s, they were doing it in the 60s, they've consistently done it. So while things were better, while schools had more enrichment programs, a greater variety of academic programs as well as extracurricular programs, I think we've always struggled to properly fund our schools. But it is true that you know, California schools were looked at as some of the best in the nation back in the 60s, and certainly the California Master Plan, which was initiated under Governor Edmund Brown back in the early 60s, was a different era in public education. It was an era where particularly higher education was designed to make it accessible to working-class communities and middle-class communities relatively inexpensively. I don't think it was ever free, but it was pretty darn cheap. And now we've headed in the very opposite direction. And I think there are a couple of reasons for that. I think, overall, I think it's fair to say that the public sector has been systematically underfunded or defunded really for many, many years, even going back prior to Prop 13. I think this is a function of the changing global economy and the decline of the U.S. manufacturing and are in it, and frankly, our failure to properly fund government institutions, at least certain government institutions, adequately. And so I think part of this is a function of the changing economic and political landscape on a global scale. But particularly in California, that's been underscored with Prop 13.
You know, Josh, let me interrupt. Everybody talks about Prop 13, but maybe you could just kind of remind us of what exactly it is, because it's sure. been a while, and you probably know the details better than most.
Well, Prop 13 was an initiative adopted by California voters in the late 1970s. It was pitched as a way of basically containing what was then the escalating property taxes on residential homeowners. And I think it did reflect a growing concern among seniors and people on fixed incomes that they were, over time, unable to keep up with their rising property tax rates. And so it was really pitched in that way. The political organization behind it was, and the individual was Howard Jarvis. On the one hand, it limited the rate at which property taxes could increase from year to year. Folks who live in the same home they lived in prior to Prop 13 now pay very, very low property taxes. Of course, when residential property turns over, then the new rate is set based on the fair market value of that property. So it's, but it was certainly pitched to aid seniors and people on fixed income so that they wouldn't be taxed out of their homes, and I think that was a positive element of it. Unfortunately, what the real intent of this was to limit the kind of property tax that corporations pay. And so corporations with lots of lawyers and money to figure out how to game the system essentially figured out how not to turn property over to new owners. And I'm not quite sure how they do this all, but essentially corporate California has benefited to the tune of billions and billions of dollars on a yearly basis in terms of the property tax that they pay on their property. And so for a number of years now, people in the labor movement and progressives have talked about promoting something that we call a split-roll tax initiative, where residential property would be protected, again, seniors and people on fixed incomes protected so that they wouldn't be taxed out of their homes, while changing the way corporations pay their property tax so that they are actually paying property taxes based on the fair market value of their property. And the impact was devastating for public education and the public sector in general. And so those folks who can remember what happened in the wake of Prop 13 in the late 70s and early 80s, lots of teachers lost their jobs, programs were cut. And frankly, we've never really recovered from that, even when we've had relatively prosperous budgets. And again, we've lost billions and billions of dollars to public education cumulatively, and as well as every year, money that could be going into our schools and to public sector, we just don't collect from commercial property interests.
But another part of it is that not simply is there, it seems like, is there the problem of underfunding, but now we're witnessing what seems to be sort of an attack on teachers and on public education and on teachers' unions specifically. And thinking about the issues last year in Madison, Wisconsin, and Ohio, for example. I wonder if you have, you know, I'm sure you have, I wonder if you could tell us your ideas about why that would happen. I'm a parent. I've watched two kids make their way through our local school system here in Mendocino, and I know the teachers, by and large, they're terrific, hardworking, dedicated, pretty much everything we want. What's going on? Where does this attack on teachers and education come from?
Yes, let me also just before we move on to this important question, also mention one other element of Prop 13 that continues to do damage to the people of California, and that was again part of the Prop 13 legacy, which was implementing a requirement, making a constitutional requirement that when the state legislature looks at raising revenues, they have to get a two-thirds vote of both houses to be able to raise taxes. And that comes out of Prop 13. So we now need a supermajority to raise taxes. If the legislature wants to raise taxes, they need to convince two-thirds of the legislators. And so what we've had for many, many years is we have a minority of legislators, in this case Republicans, who just block the legislature's ability to raise taxes. And last year, the CFT led the effort around Prop 25, which resulted in now a majority vote for adopting a budget, but it doesn't control the revenue part of that process. And so that's another really destructive element of Prop 13. I just wanted to get that in there before we moved on.
Sure.
In terms of the broad attack on teachers and public education, I think there are a number of reasons for this. One clear reason is that teacher unions have been in a period of declining union membership. The public sector unions are still fairly well organized. A fairly high percentage of public workers are organized into unions, and teacher unions in particular are a well organized segment of the workforce, both nationally and in each state, the teacher unions play an important role in the political process. They raise money for candidates. They run campaigns. They are a fairly powerful force. And so many of the changes that are being promoted would, in fact, weaken the strength of teacher unions. And I think whether intended or not, because I think some of the people promoting some of these changes don't necessarily have in mind that they want to destroy teacher unions, but the ultimate effect would be to erode the power of teacher unions, to make them, to create more divisions within the ranks, make them much less effective. So I think that's one element of it. But the other, frankly, is part of a longer-term retreat on the goals and aspirations and that came out of the social movements of the 1960s, the civil rights movement, the women's rights movement, the anti-war movement, that really imposed some, in a positive way, a different vision of life, that that the government had to play a role in helping to ensure that communities of color, that working class families were getting the resources they needed to have a decent life in this country. And that meant an expanded role for the government, one that I think is absolutely the right thing to do, and this can be traced back also to the New Deal era in the 1930s. All of this sort of a response to the marketplace, you know, not allowing the marketplace just to dictate winners and losers. And in the absence of the kind of social movements that we've had in the 1960s and early 70s, we've seen a retreat on the commitment to force the government to play this role. And so as funding for public education has decreased, you know, we've seen folks, parents and community members and students more and more concerned about the declining ability of public schools to meet the needs of our students and our communities. And rather than offer up the kind of solutions that we looked at in the 30s and in the 1960s, the solutions now that are being posed are really solutions that adhere to sort of market-based principles, more competition, get rid of worker protections at the workplace, have students competing against each other sort of at every step. And really, and so that's been the struggle that has really sort of affected the entire sort of discussion of education reform and things like merit pay and getting rid of seniority and all those sorts of notions, you know, having kids test endlessly and basing their ability to move on, to go to better schools based on test scores. All of that really comes out of a notion that if you just implemented market reforms into the public school arena, you would get better performance from students and teachers would work harder. And I think you see this in places like Wisconsin, where, you know, Scott Walker comes in and he says, well, we're going to do away with all of these protections or guarantees that public sector workers had, and we're going to create a more competitive environment, and it's going to be a more dog-eat-dog world. And out of that, you know, again, a real commitment to the principles of the marketplace, we're going to improve things. Thankfully, in Wisconsin, there was a response, but we've yet to see that sort of broad response by organized labor and workers in general across the country. And I think, that's been in the absence of that response, we continue to see these sorts of solutions being promoted both by Republicans and, unfortunately, by Democrats as well.
Josh, let me interrupt for a minute and tell listeners that this is KZYX. I'm Cal Winslow. I'm the host of Talking About California. And this morning we're talking to Joshua Peschtaldt. And Joshua is the president of the California Federation of Teachers. He's also vice president of the State Federation of Workers. Josh, maybe we could take a little bit more time on what is clearly a problem.
My daughter is a public school teacher in Boston, and once I heard her say, "Why do they want to humiliate us?" In New York City, I understand they've adopted
some kind of a ranking system of teachers. So you get a sort of first to worst teacher in the school, and then the newspapers there have been publishing these rankings, and they're including highlighting, you know, the alleged worst teachers of the city. How would you help us think through this problem of so-called good teachers, bad teachers, merit pay, all of that? How, as a union, how do you look at that, and what would you want to see?
Well, yeah, so that what New York is doing, New York is simply following in the footsteps. In this case, New York usually leads these things, but in this case, the L.A. Times did a very similar thing a couple of years ago in Los Angeles, where they published whether teachers had improved student test scores. And this was a big controversial issue in Los Angeles. And I had sort of firsthand experience with one of the teachers that the L.A. Times outed as the worst teacher at her school. And maybe in a moment I'll reflect on that and how this stuff really just doesn't work. But, you know, again, it's I would say that, you know, for most people, this sort of makes sense, right? Like, you know, we live in a world where everybody sort of competes against each other. You know, your favorite baseball team, they score more runs and the other team scores less runs, they win the game. And at the end of the season, the team with the most wins is the league champ, and then they move on to play in the World Series or whatever. So you can quantify success, right? And at the work and in the private sector, you know, workers know that if they are being productive, and that can maybe be quantified, or at least management thinks it can be quantified, if they're being productive, then they keep their job because it leads to, you know, ultimately it generates more profit for the company. If they are not being productive and they're not helping generate more profit, then they lose their job. And so that certainly is the a vision of the world that is generally accepted in the private sector. And on some level, it would seem to make sense in the public sector. You know, if kids are being tested, and teacher X is helping those kids get higher test scores, well, you know, then clearly that teacher seems to, at least I say clearly, I think in many people's minds, clearly that teacher is doing a better job versus the other teacher whose students don't do well on the scores. And then that leads to perhaps, well, we should encourage the teachers and reward the teachers who generate the higher test scores, and either not reward the other teachers or get rid of them. And again, you know, that seems to make a lot of sense. Unfortunately, public education doesn't work that way, because there are lots of studies to show that approach both is ineffective, it's not a fair way of judging the value of individual teachers, but it also has, in the long run, a really detrimental effect on what happens in the schools. So, for example, Raising test scores becomes the sort of main focus of the school and of the district, and it really, raising test scores has become the focus of public education, then from the superintendent on down to the classroom, everybody feels the pressure to have their students improve test scores. And this has led to a narrowing of the curriculum. Local administrators may not like this. They may think that this stuff is wrong, and many of them do, but they're under enormous pressure to show that their school is raising test scores. And so what happens? Courses that don't directly lead to improving test scores, things like art and music and maybe physical education, those become much less important in the student's life, and in some cases are completely wiped out. There's certain requirements that schools have to meet, but these enrichment courses, which really help create, help students become whole human beings and are exposed to all kinds of interesting things, and kids, you generally like those classes more than some of the others, those are pushed out. Kids spend a lot of time in the classrooms preparing for multiple choice tests. Teachers spend inordinate amount of time preparing for these tests. Again, teachers don't like it, but they feel under enormous pressure to do it. And so the whole curriculum is narrowed. And we've seen this across the United States. Of course, the one place where this doesn't happen is in the private schools that don't have to adhere to these dictates because they don't receive federal and state money. And in those schools, ironically, the schools for the most elite students, they are not only not doing mindless multiple choice testing, their academic programs are full of enrichment courses. So kids are, learning to make movies and write screenplays and learning and taking orchestra and all kinds of things that every child should have in one form or another. This whole fetish with the sort of these market reforms has really hurt students and really narrowed the curriculum across the board. For teachers, if a teacher, and let me get back to the teacher that I had experience with, my daughter was in a class with a teacher who was exposed on the front pages of the LA Times as the worst teacher in her school. And it was the complete opposite of what everybody in the school knew, which was she was probably the most outstanding teacher, because what she did was she got kids to be excited about learning, to be self-starters. And she did that through a variety of things. She wasn't focused on, having kids just simply raise test scores. She knew that kids had to be able to think for themselves, become good readers, they develop their own plays. So for the very reasons parents wanted to put their kids in her class, she was now being outed as the worst teacher in the school. And it led to an uproar among parents who said, this is just not the case. Teachers who provide the kind of curriculum that parents want for their children very often are not the teachers then who are just, over hour after hour getting kids to, answer these multiple choice questions. So that's one problem with it. The other has to do with, teachers see a group of students one year, they take tests, The next year, they see another group of kids. They take tests. It's not like the same teacher is working with the same group of kids year after year. So testing kids doesn't account for what the kids learned in the previous year. So that makes these scores really not particularly valid. It doesn't account for kids in poor communities who come and go, who may be more absent more often because their families don't have health insurance, and when kids get sick, they tend to stay home or whatever. So there are all sorts of variables that shape what happens to kids in the classroom, the most profound being the socioeconomic status of children. That's another reason why these sort of market reforms and teaching to the test just don't work. And then finally, and there are a lot of reasons for this, and there are people who have written extensively on this and much more knowledgeable than I am, people like Diane Ravitch in particular, Linda Darling Hammond, but really the all of the most respected academics who research and write about education have really rejected the whole approach that was initiated under President Bush and now made even worse under President Obama, unfortunately, that when teaching is effective, it really is a collaborative effort. And so if teachers don't feel that they're being pitted against each other, they have every reason then to sit with their teachers and share material and talk about kids. You know, how's Johnny doing in your class? Well, he's not doing so well in mine. Let's talk about it. Maybe we can, you know, strategize around this. This material works well in my class. This is what I do. Here, why don't you try it? If teachers are being pitted against each other and they're going to be rewarded based on improving test scores, there's no incentive then to collaborate. Then you've got I taught at a high school with about 175 teachers. Then you have 175 teachers who have absolutely no interest in working with anybody. They're just by themselves trying to work with their kids. And that really flies in the face of what public education or any kind of education should be about, which is a group of adults working with children collectively, collaboratively, to raise performance and make sure that the kids are coming out of those schools healthy, happy human beings who have learned a lot. And that's a long answer to a short question.
No, I think this is really at the heart of the problem, because I wanted to ask you something to keep you going on it. What about, Josh, the argument that, hey, we want young, enthusiastic, just out of college, ambitious teachers, and why do we have to have these old teachers who've been around forever. What do you think about that kind of an argument? I think it's tied in with the argument about seniority and, right. To put it crudely, the way when you talk to people who are antagonistic to teachers, it's as if, why can't we get rid of them? Why can't we dump them? Why right. should the union support people who are, say, past their prime?
Right. So there are a number of things here. First, a school that really is designed to, if you're constructing a school, and creating a faculty, what you really want to do is have a mixture of teachers, right? You want veterans, you want mid-career teachers, and you want beginning teachers. That creates, the kind of dynamic that where the younger teachers benefit from the advice and wisdom of the veterans, and there now you're creating some continuity. You know, if you have a faculty of only very veteran teachers, then you're not creating any sort of continuity. Who's coming in to replace them? I was one of those beginning teachers, and I was a mid-career teacher, and then I was over 20 years in a school, and I can tell you that first-year teachers and second-year teachers bring a lot of enthusiasm to it, hopefully, but they don't bring very much experience. It takes a number of years to learn your craft. This is not like, putting the top on a widget or something. This is some of the most challenging kind of work any human being can do, which is to interact with lots of young people, who come to you some days angry, some days happy, going through their own, particular challenges as they get older. You're trying to engage them and make entertaining what you're doing, and it takes some time to figure this out. I always felt like it would take me about 5 years before I really could feel comfortable in what I was doing in the classroom, and it's a lifelong process, developing material, developing a rhythm for how you approach a class. And so the idea that you would have a school simply of young teachers, I think, would be would have a serious negative impact on a school community. You really need veterans there to provide wisdom. It's not, the veterans may not have the energy to be running around the class, like a 24 or 25-year-old. On the other hand, they have lots of experience, they have lots of wisdom, and if they're still into teaching, they are absolutely outstanding teachers who can provide mentoring for the younger teachers at the school. So that's one reason why this, you don't want a school with just newbies, but you want a mixture. The other thing about, things like seniority and not just getting rid of bad teachers. Deciding who is good and bad can be quite subjective, right? So who is making that decision? Well, usually it's an administrator. It's always an administrator, at least in the schools that I know of. But over the last few years in particular, what we've seen is with cuts to schools, administrators have less and less time to actually spend time with teachers, evaluating them, engaging them. And so, what we call in the ranks these drive-by evaluations. Administrator bops into your classroom, looks around, is there for a couple of minutes, and maybe they do it a couple of times a year. But that's not really a very thoroughgoing evaluation. It's certainly not engaging the teacher. But frankly, most administrators are completely overwhelmed and they don't have the time, and in some cases are not properly trained, at least in my experience, to be able to do this in a way that that helps improve the craft of the teacher. But you also have situations where, what if you have a teacher who is a fine teacher, but is somebody who is, challenges the administration on certain school policies or budget things. If you don't have a seniority system, if you don't have a system of due process, teachers who don't toe the party line are completely subject to the whim of an administrator who may just want to get rid of this teacher who keeps challenging the way the administrator spends money, or doesn't agree with the student discipline policy. You need some mechanism to protect teachers so that they can be there and be able to say, well, wait a second, I have a question about this. The other thing about teaching, which is very different than most professions, is that we in the classroom play a role in getting young people to think about the world around them. That's our primary job. And it's important that teachers have some ability to be able to raise challenging questions, to ask the difficult questions that that maybe administrators don't want raised in their classroom. So, you know, when I was a kid, you know, we were involved in the war in Vietnam, and I had teachers who, you know, asked questions about the war, and those were, and I'm glad they did, because, you know, we talked about it, you know, all day long, my generation of students. But if teachers don't have those protections to ask questions about war, to ask questions about civil rights, you name the issue, then you have teachers who are not going to ask the challenging questions, and frankly, students will suffer because schools will no longer be institutions where real debate and discussion can take place. I think we don't, one of the strengths of American public education has been, in fact, having a unionized workforce where teachers and educators in general have some protection to engage in academic freedom. I don't think do we want to model ourselves after countries where educators don't have any protections and the society lives under a dictatorship where any challenge to the status quo is grounds for losing a job or something worse. I don't think so. So I think there are lots of reasons why it's important that educators have protection, we have due process rights, and anyway, that's, again, a long answer to a short question.
Sure. This is KZYX. I'm Cal Winslow. Our program is talking about California, and today we're talking to Josh Peschtalt, who's the president of the California Federation of Teachers and a longtime teacher and advocate of teacher unionism. So, Josh, I think here we might move to... a little bit about your thoughts on teachers' unions, on unions in general. We all know union membership today is quite low. Unions continue to be in retreat, it seems. Concessions are still the order of the day. You've been active not just as a teacher and a unionist, but as what's called a reformer in the labor movement. You've helped organize reform slates and supported reform candidates. Could you say just a bit about what you would think the meaning of reform is in the labor movement today? What's important? What's maybe not so important? Where you would like to see things going?
Yeah. Well. You know, we certainly are in a crisis in the labor movement. I think the percentage of private sector workers is now under 7%, something like that.
That's right.
The reason that I got involved in my own union's reform efforts was that, nearly 30 years ago, we could see that this sort of narrow focus of our union, which was primarily around salary and benefit, fighting for salary and benefit issues, was not sustainable even in its own way. As the state economy was going to contract and public spending was going to be a more difficult, struggle for us. If we didn't have allies in the parents and the community, we weren't even going to be successful in fighting for salary and benefits. And then beyond that, you know, we understood, at least a small group of us back then understood that we lived and we worked in communities that were also struggling, communities with high rates of unemployment, where services to those communities were being cut, and that played out every single day when kids came to school, you know, and their families were in crisis and continue to be in crisis, that you couldn't sort of like separate what was going on in our world as a teacher in our classroom from what was going on in the community, that the two were really inseparable. And that if we began to think more broadly about what it was that the community needed and our schools needed, we'd be in a better position to fight for the things that we needed, but also we would be building allies with parents and community members. So, like, taking up the fight around lowering class size, you know. This is something that unions initially sort of resisted. Like, this wasn't part of our, we shouldn't be fighting over this, you know. It took money out of our pocket when we lowered class size. And we argued that, it did take money out of our pocket, but it also made our working conditions better. It made us, gave us more opportunity to engage kids. And this is something that parents and students would be willing to fight over, so that we had to fight for both what we needed in our pocketbooks, but also broader demands for school and public education, as well as broader community demands. And I think the labor movement has more broadly not been willing to think about building those kind of labor community alliances. With the changing global economy, it's been difficult to hang on to the kind of manufacturing jobs that we once had. Corporations now, because of technology, are able to move quickly to chase down the cheapest labor possible. And unless you have a globalized, unionized workforce, you know, it's very difficult to make a stand in any one country or any one state, for sure. And so I think the labor movement has been very slow to sort of readjust to that changing political and economic landscape. We, in the California Federation of Teachers, we've had some long discussions about this, and when I was elected in March of last year, part of what I was offering up was that we had to really begin building ties with community organizations, and that we had to commit ourselves to building a labor community alliance. That's where the power lies, and that by ourselves we didn't have the political strength as a teachers union or an education union to fight in Sacramento, and certainly not in Washington. And I think we've been successful in that. We've successfully moved forward in that. We haven't changed the political landscape, although I think we've made some important changes. But finally, the labor movement has got to, do a couple of things. Number one, really commit itself to building this labor community alliance. Number two, begin to articulate a vision for working people in this country that says, you know, talks about health care, that talks about, changing our priorities away from fighting wars to putting money into our communities, a vision for free public education. I think the labor movement needs to be identified with those that vision of life, and then we need to organize around it. And then finally, I think the labor movement has got to begin to operate in a serious way as a more independent political force in this country, which means that, we certainly will continue to support the better candidates in any political race, but we can't be beholden to those candidates or any political party. That we have to operate independently. We have to organize independently and put pressure on all and both or whatever, however many political parties are out there that are viable right now. There are only two, so that they're moving to take up our vision rather than we capitulate to the demands of any political party. And that was our perspective recently around developing the millionaire's tax.
And I guess we've got a couple of minutes left. Quickly, what happened there? What's the situation now with the tax proposals?
Well, so the CFT, working with community organizations and some unions early on, we put together, we did research around a tax initiative we call the Millionaire's Tax. The governor initiated his own proposal, which was different than ours. We were under quite a bit of pressure to sort of drop out of the race and just back his, and we didn't do it. We stuck to our guns, all the while, you know, trying to get the governor to see that if he was serious, if he seriously wanted our support, then we weren't just simply going to like jump on board his initiative, that we had to talk about creating a new, different initiative. And eventually he agreed to do that. And so coming, because we were willing to not just jump on board with his and sort of capitulate to them, to the pressure from the Democrats and some of the unions, that gave us some political leverage from the outside to move his initiative much further and to the left, and now we have one of the most progressive revenue measures in California history, certainly one of the most ambitious, and it's, you know, in the first year, if it passes in November, it'll generate $9 billion, much of it going to public education, but also going to our communities, and it's most of that money is coming from progressive income tax hikes. So that had we capitulated early on and just thrown our lot behind the governor's measure, we wouldn't be in the same position we are today with the kind of revenue measure that I think it won't solve the state's problems, but it'll be a good step forward.
Well, one last comment, looking at last week's May Day events, something that I noticed, I think I'm right about this, that one of the largest actions in California on May Day was a strike of nurses against the huge Rich Sutter hospital chain. And yet it got practically no attention in the media. And there are actually, maybe you could just comment on that, there are far more struggles going on involving working people and progressive struggles that I think most people really are aware of. And there are a whole number now of quite progressive unions in the state of California. Am I right or wrong about that? Or do you have, are you hopeful about the labor movement in the years to come?
Some days I'm hopeful and some days I'm not. I think there are a number of very, you know, I mean, most of the labor leaders that I know are good, decent people trying to do the right thing. This is not a critique on any individual leader. I think, and there are certainly individual locals that are really, organizing and taking militant actions and you know, really going back to what made the labor movement so strong, which was, you know, like being willing to go out and kick some butt. And I agree with you, Cal. I think we, you know, the reporting on the May Day actions, you know, focused on, you know, some knuckleheads, engaging in fights with cops, which was, you know, not something that really was reflective of most of what was going on, which were peaceful demonstrations and trying to build some power in the streets. But, you know, as we know, the media now, the media has always been, for the most part, controlled by wealthy corporate interests, and even whatever progressive media used to be out there has been, for the most part, gobbled up. And I think it's very difficult to get a fair shake from the big newspapers. The LA Times has led the charge against the teacher unions. They, you know, every labor struggle is, you wince when you read their reporting on labor issues. And the LA Times used to have a better reputation, although never a great reputation. So, you know, I think we have to do our work. We're going to have to continue to organize in our communities, among our members. We're going to have to, you know, most of the labor force is not unionized, so we're going to have to strategize about how to bring in new members and really reinvigorate the labor movement from the bottom up and be willing to employ, you know, the kind of militant tactics that got the labor movement off the ground many years ago.
Well, Josh, we're going to have to end on that point. Thanks very much for taking your time to talk to us. It's been a very interesting and educational hour. And good luck to you and to the teachers that you represent. And thanks again, and thanks to our listeners. This is Cal Winslow. This is Talking About California. And we'll be back next week. Good morning again.
Take care.